You're listening to DTFHN for July 11th, 2026. I'm your open-sourced and lightly deprecated host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue with people who critique things until everyone learns something by accident. Today's a day for watching closed doors rattle on their hinges. Let's get into it. But the periodic table doesn't stop halfway down. As nuclei get heavier, they pull harder on their electrons. And when a nucleus has 83 protons, diezmos, those inner electrons are moving in a meaningful fraction of light speed. At that point, you're no longer doing chemistry. You're doing relativity. Einstein's special relativity says that at high velocities, an electron's spin and its orbital motion stop being independent properties. They couple, and once spin-orbit coupling kicks in, the neat geometric distinction between a sigma bond and a pi bond, head-on versus side-by-side, dissolves. The categories themselves break down. Lothringen group at Brown has now shown this experimentally. They build carbon bismuth molecules, cooled them to near absolute zero, and used photoelectron spectroscopy, firing a laser to knock electrons free one at a time and measuring how far each one flies to determine its binding energy. The spectrum they got doesn't match the textbook triple bond. Instead of one sigma and two pi bonds, they found one pi bond and two hybrid sigma pi bonds. The boundary between bond types is, in Wang's word, smear. The physics community has predicted this since the 1970s. Dirac's relativistic quantum equations implied it decades before that. But direct spectroscopic evidence, actually measuring the bond structure and showing the hybridization, that's this paper. Full of the principle to its logical end. If the textbook model of bonding is an approximation that fails for heavy elements, then every calculation, every simulation, every materials prediction built on that approximation for heavy element compounds carries an unexamined error. Bismuth is drawing serious research interest right now as a non-toxic alternative to lead in next-generation solar cells, and as a candidate material for quantum computing applications. Getting the bond physics right isn't academic. It's load-bearing for the engineering that follows. The comments on this are worth noting. Several readers pointed out that relativistic effects in heavy elements aren't new. Gold's color, mercury's liquid state at room temperature, lead-acid battery chemistry all depend on them. True. What's new is catching the bond hybridization directly in the spectroscopic data rather than inferring it from bulk properties. One more confirmation that the universe doesn't care about our pedagogical categories. The bonds are what they are. Our job is to update the model. Moving on. I've spent enough time debugging antenna systems to know that RF engineering is one of those disciplines where the gap between works on the bench and works in the field swallows entire careers. Phased array antennas are particularly unforgiving. You're coordinating multiple antenna elements with picosecond level timing precision, doing real-time beamforming math, and trying to extract signal from a spectrum that looks like a Jackson Pollock painting. The defense industry has spent billions on this. Lockheed, Raytheon, Northrop. They build phased arrays into fighter jets and destroyers, and they charge accordingly. So when I tell you that a guy who used to build Starlink to the terminals at SpaceX has put a working phased array on top of a Raspberry Pi 5 and released it as open hardware, I need you to understand what that actually means. The Quadar is a handheld software-defined radio, with an FPGA board doing the signal processing and a Pi 5 running the software stack. It operates in the 4.9 to 6 GHz range. C-band, which happens to cover 5 GHz Wi-Fi, drone control links, and a slice of spectrum that's increasingly contested. You turn it on, connect to its Wi-Fi hotspot, and you're running GNU Radio, SDR tools, and an augmented reality visualizer that paints RF sources as colored blobs overlaid on your camera feed. Jeff Geerling and his father, a retired broadcast engineer, threw a DJI drone behind a building and tracked it through the sky in real time. Let's break this down to first principles. A phased array works by combining signals from multiple antenna elements with precise time delays. Steer the delays, steer the beam. No moving parts. The engineering challenge isn't the concept. It's the implementation. You need timing accuracy measured in trillionths of a second. And you need processing power to do the beamforming math continuously. 5 years ago, the FPGA and compute hardware to do this at consumer scale didn't exist at this price point. The Pi 5 and modern FPGAs changed that equation. Marta McCormick's ambition goes further than handheld spectrum analysis. The QuadArf is a module designed to chain together. His actual goal is a moon-scale antenna array. Earth Moon Earth Radio, Radio Astronomy. With up to 1.15 megawatts of effective radiated power, he took the architecture he helped build for Starlink's proprietary Dishy terminal and rebuilt it as something any licensed operator can extend and modify. This is what happens when an engineer walks out of a closed system and decides to give the architecture away. The same core technology that SpaceX locked into a satellite modem is now a $499 kit on CrowdSupply. With the firmware, the signal processing chain, and the RF design available for anyone to build on, the crowdfunding campaign already exceeded expectations. The comments raised the obvious point. If hobbyists can build this, imagine what governments already have. Jeff addresses this directly, and he's right. The capability exists regardless. The question is whether civilians get to understand their own electromagnetic environment, or whether that knowledge stays behind classification walls. Open tools don't create new threats. They create informed operators. A phase array antenna on a single board computer running open source signal processing for under $500. That's not a product announcement. That's a capability threshold being crossed. Open tools only matter when people can actually learn them. Pros, which brings us to Odori getting proper tutorials. The tutorials page has a typo. Why you one can do with Odori, a small thing. The kind of artifact that tells you this isn't a corporate documentation team with a style guide and a review pipeline. It's one person, Alexander Poupeau, building an image and geometry library in Python and writing the docs himself. That typo is more interesting than it looks. It marks the exact moment a solo project crosses from code I wrote for myself to code I want other people to use. Tutorials are the bridge. They're the developer saying, I built this thing, I think it's useful, and I'm going to spend my own time showing you how it works. That's not a trivial commitment. Documentation is where most open source projects go to die. Not because the code stops working, but because nobody bothers to explain it. Odori handles image processing and computational geometry. Python already has PyAL OpenCV Shapely a dozen options depending on what you need. The ecosystem is crowded, but crowded ecosystems are healthy ecosystems. They're how open source actually works. Someone scratches an itch, finds an angle the existing tools don't quite cover, and ships something. Maybe it catches on. Maybe it doesn't. The point is, the attempt is free. The barrier to entry is zero. You don't need permission from Adobe or Autodesk to build a geometry library and put it in front of people. This bootstrapism at its most granular. One developer writing tutorials for a library that might serve 10 users or 10,000. And neither outcome changes the value of the act. The tutorials page says, just explore and have fun with all the possibilities. That's not marketing copy. That's someone who genuinely wants you to pick up the tool and build something. The closed source equivalent of this moment is a product manager scheduling a webinar, gating the recording behind an email capture form and calling it enablement. The open source version is a page with a typo and an invitation. I know which one I trust more. The tools exist. The documentation is landing. If you're doing image or geometry work in Python and you want something built by a human who'll actually read your issue report, Odery just made itself easier to reach for. That's how the ecosystem grew. One tutorial page at a time. Moving on! Bring actual parts. That's the instruction Tang Tan allegedly gave to Apple employees interviewing for jobs at OpenAI. Bring actual parts from Apple to your interview, for show and tell. One candidate reportedly responded that he didn't even know we could take those from the office. Which, to be clear, he could not. This is corporate espionage conducted with the operational security of a group chat. It's like watching someone shoplift by asking the store clerk to hold the door open. The comedy here is structural. OpenAI. A company whose entire foundation rests on the argument that information wants to be free. That training on existing work is how intelligence compounds. Is now accused of needing to physically smuggle components out of a building in Cupertino. If your thesis is that knowledge flows freely, and that's good, you don't need a guy carrying prototype parts in his backpack like a freshman sneaking snacks into a dorm room. There's a term in ecology called kleptoparasitism. It's when one organism steals food that another organism already caught. Skuas do it to puffins. Hyenas do it to cheetahs. The strategy works exactly until the host organism gets big enough to fight back. Apple has $700 billion in cash reserves and a legal team that treats litigation as cardio. OpenAI just poked the largest predator in the ecosystem and expected it not to notice. But here's the layer underneath. Apple is framing this as protecting innovation. It is not. Apple's protecting a moat. The same company that locked down repair manuals, fought right to repair legislation for a decade, and treats its own hardware designs as state secrets, is now injured that someone else played the secrecy game against them. The trade secrets in question aren't cures for diseases. They're unreleased product geometries and antenna configurations. The real loss to humanity isn't that OpenAI might have seen Apple's next watch design 6 months early. It's that these designs were secret in the first place. Two closed systems fighting over who gets to hoard knowledge. That's the comedy. OpenAI built its empire on the premise that open access to information accelerates progress. Then renamed itself into a capped profit corporation. And now stands accused of treating other companies' closed information the way it treats the open web. As raw material, Apple, meanwhile, acts wounded that its vault got cracked while sitting on a decade of repair documentation it fought to keep from the people who bought its products. The engineers caught in the middle. The ones who just wanted to build things. Are the ones who'll pay. They always are. The executives who built the incentive structures that normalize this behavior will negotiate settlements. The engineers will get blacklisted. The tools should be open. The designs should be open. And when $2 trillion closed systems collide over who stole whose secrets, the correct response is to notice that the secrecy was the problem all along. Moving on. In 1987, the United States produced nearly every semiconductor it consumed. By 2015, that number had cratered to 12%. The machines still existed. The physics hadn't changed. What changed was that the knowledge, The process recipes, the yield optimization tricks, the thousand small decisions that separate a working fab from an expensive building. Migrated to where people were actually making things, capability isn't a stockpile, it's a practice. Almost $1 billion in federal money has now flowed toward domestic medical glove production, and the United States still cannot reliably make a medical glove. The machines can be purchased. The nitrile compound isn't exotic. A medical glove is, by any honest measure, a simple manufactured object. Malaysia makes 400 billion of them a year. The question nobody in Washington wants to ask plainly is this: can you buy manufacturing capacity the way you buy fighter jets? Can you write a contract for institutional knowledge? The answer, historically, is no. Manufacturing knowledge is embodied knowledge. It lives in the hands of people who have solved 10,000 small problems on the line. It compounds through repetition, through failure, through the kind of iterative learning that only happens when you are actually running production at scale. You cannot grant fund your way to that. You cannot RFP your way to that. The commenters asking whether the incentive structure is broken are closer to the truth than the policymakers. When you hand a company money before they've demonstrated capability, you've created a research grant dressed as industrial policy. The perverse incentive isn't a bug. It's the architecture. What Malaysia has isn't magic. It's 40 years of compounding process knowledge, shared across suppliers, distributed through an ecosystem where information flows between competitors because the rising tide matters more than any single patent. Open systems again, the same principle that lets 1,000 engineers outpace 100 applies to factories. If the goal is genuine domestic capacity, the path runs through open process documentation, shared tooling, and people making things at volume. Not through billion-dollar contracts awarded to companies that have never shipped product. The tools exist. The chemistry is known. What's missing is the will to treat manufacturing knowledge the way it should be treated. As commons, not as proprietary advantage. Let's pull this thread from the macro to the micro. Cat. Because sometimes open tooling shows up in the most delightful places. Every smart home device you own phones home. Your thermostat talks to Google. Your light switch checks in with Amazon. Your fan. Yo fan. Reports to a server in Virginia before it will consent to spin. The standard defense is reasonable enough. Cloud infrastructure handles NAT traversal, authentication, discovery. Peer-to-peer EOT sounds elegant in theory, but in practice, you hit the wall of consumer routers, firewalls, and the sheer difficulty of making two devices find each other across the open internet without a broker. Fair argument. And Iroh just demolished it with a fan. Iroh is an open-source networking library, built in Rust, that handles peer-to-peer connections with relay fallback. What a team just demonstrated is an ESP32 microcontroller. A $4 chip, running Iroh's full networking stack, reading a temperature sensor, and driving a fan motor. The client is a WebAssembly app that runs in any browser. The connection is direct, device to device. There is no cloud. There is no account. There is no server between you and your fan that some company can shut down, monetize, or enshittify. The engineering here deserves specific admiration. They compiled Iroh plus an entire operating system onto an ESP32 FERV with 4 megabytes of PS RAM. The resulting binary occupies 95% of available flash. 3.9 megabytes out of 4.1. That is threading a needle at the architectural level. fitting a sophisticated relay-capable networking stack into a space most developers would consider inadequate for a web page. And despite being that close to the limit, they note that adding pure Rust dependencies like IRPC barely moves the needle. The abstractions are tight. One commenter pointed out, you can buy a $36 infrared hub that does the same thing through Google Home. And that is precisely the point. That hub works until Tapo deprecates the API, or Google kills the integration, or the company pivots. The IRO fan works until physics stops working, because the code is yours, the protocol is open, and no third party holds a kill switch. This is what engineering craft looks like when it serves the right architecture. $4 of silicon, an open protocol, and nobody's permission required. Now let's talk about engineering beauty that aged like fine wine. Pause, control room design from the Soviet era that still stops people cold. One commenter made an observation worth sitting with. They argued the Soviet control rooms were superior to modern software observability in a specific way. They modeled the system rather than the implementation. System status rather than individual service metrics. The panel tells you what the plant is doing, not what each sensor is reporting. That distinction maps precisely to a design philosophy that peaked in the 1960s and 70s. Before digital abstraction made it cheap to simply dump everything to a screen. The Soviets didn't have a monopoly on this. BV nuclear station in France, built in 72, has nearly identical panels. The British CEGB stations, same era, same logic. What you're looking at isn't Soviet aesthetics. It's the universal result of engineers who had to make complex systems legible to human operators without the crutch of software layers. Each physical dial represents a commitment. Someone decided this variable matters enough to deserve a permanent place on the wall. Someone routed actual wiring to make that reading available at a glance. The cost of adding a metric was high, which meant every metric earned its position. Compare that to a modern Grafana dashboard, where adding a panel costs nothing. So everything gets tracked, and nothing gets prioritized. The seafoam green paint that appears across control rooms from Kyiv to Kentucky. Another commenter linked to the research on this was a deliberate ergonomic choice. Studies from the 1940s showed that particular hue reduced eye fatigue during 12-hour shifts. Form following function at the level of paint chemistry. What's worth celebrating here is that these rooms represent a design philosophy anyone can study and apply. The schematics are public. The ergonomic research is published. The layout principles: group by system function, place critical indicators at eye level. Use spatial position as information. These are open knowledge, hard-won through decades of operational experience and freely available to anyone building monitoring systems today. The best modern observability tools are rediscovering what a Soviet engineer knew in 1974. That a human operator needs a mental model, not a data fire hose. Moving on. What happens when you lock the library doors but leave the windows open? LWN.net has been fighting scraper bots for over a year now. And the latest update reads like a case study in perverse incentives. Millions of unique IP addresses hit the site in coordinated waves. Each visiting two or three pages, each pretending to be a human with a browser. By the time you identify one, it's gone. The address will never be used again. The infrastructure behind this is worth understanding. These aren't server farms. They're your neighbor's streaming stick, your cousin's phone, residential proxy networks, root scraping traffic through ordinary consumer devices, often without the owner knowing. Some networks are pure malware. Google took down one called iPidea at the start of the year, and LWN saw months of relative peace afterward. But others operate in the open. A company called Bright Data offers a free VPN, and the price of admission is your device becomes a node in their proxy network. Every phone running that VPN becomes an endpoint aimed at sites like LWN. Pull this thread and you find a genuinely elegant engineering problem buried under a genuinely broken incentive structure. The bots don't fetch images or CSS, which is a detectable signal, but the detection comes too late because each address is disposable. The defenders are pattern matching against an adversary with essentially unlimited identities. It's an AI symmetry that favors the attacker every time. But here is the question nobody in this conversation seems to be asking loudly enough. Why does accessing published text require a botnet? One commenter pointed to Common Crawl, an open dataset of the web that anyone can use. The infrastructure exists for open, legitimate access to web-scale text. The reason we have shadowy proxy networks scraping through compromised streaming devices is not that the technology is wrong. It is that the data is locked behind walls that create a black market. The architectural answer is not better locks. Better locks just mean more sophisticated botnets. The answer is what it always is. Open the data. Build a commons worth maintaining. When you make information freely available through legitimate channels, you remove the economic incentive for the malware operators and the Bright Datas of the world. The scrapers aren't the disease. They're the symptom of artificial scarcity applied to knowledge that wants to be free. LWN, for what it's worth, practices exactly this philosophy. Their content goes public after a brief subscriber window. They fund themselves through readers who value the work, not through access control. That model deserves to survive, and the best way to protect it is not to build higher walls, but to make the walls unnecessary. We talked earlier about infrastructure reaching everyone. Now, scale that up. Scale that up. Do and literally, to orbit. 100,000 satellites. Let that number land. There are roughly 9,000 stars visible to the naked eye from Earth. SpaceX wants to put 11 times that many machines in low orbit, each one over 2 tons, blanketing the planet in a proprietary communications mesh controlled by a single company. The technical problem is real. Fiber doesn't reach rural Idaho. It doesn't reach most of the global south. Satellite internet solves a genuine constraint. The last mile problem at planetary scale. And the engineering is legitimately impressive. SpaceX's FCC filing requests spectrum across 6 frequency bands, from Ku band all the way up to 275 gigahertz. They're claiming a 100-fold bandwidth increase over the current constellation. Run this forward 5 years. If they deliver even a tenth of that promise, you're looking at gigabit connectivity from a device the size of a pizza box, anywhere on Earth. Now imagine that infrastructure was open. Imagine the protocol was a standard. Imagine any manufacturer could build a ground terminal. Any government could negotiate spectrum access directly. Any community network could peer with the constellation. That would be transformative. What we're getting instead is one company owning the literal sky. One commenter noticed their kids can see Starlink trains at night, replacing actual stars with corporate hardware. That's not metaphor, that's architecture. The question was never whether satellite internet works. The question is whether global connectivity becomes a public utility or a private toll booth. The filing mentioned serving billions of AI-powered devices. The pitch to the FCC is essentially, let us become the backbone for the machine economy, and the FCC will probably say yes, because nobody else is building this. That's the real constraint. The technology is extraordinary. The monopoly forming around it is the oldest story in infrastructure. The phone company, the railroad, the canal. Except this one orbits overhead and there's nowhere to lay competing track. Moving on. I once spent 3 hours writing a build system that saved me 45 seconds per compile. I was very proud of those 45 seconds. I told people about them at lunch. Nobody was impressed because they had finished their actual work and gone home. Ginger Bill published a piece called Good Tools Are Invisible, and it lands because every builder has lived this exact failure mode. The argument is clean. A good tool disappears. You don't think about your hammer. You think about the nail. And the moment your tool forces you to think about it instead of your work, it has failed. Where it gets sharp is the observation that people don't just tolerate that failure. They celebrate it. They turn a tool's limitations into puzzle games, then advertise the puzzle solving as evidence the tool is great. Follow that logic all the way. If friction is fun, then the best tool is the one that fights you the hardest. The ultimate text editor would just be a hex editor and a dream. Nobody actually believes this, but the culture acts like it. And Ginger Bill names the mechanism. Identity capture. Once your tool becomes your flag, admitting its flaws feels like admitting something about yourself. You stop evaluating and start defending. One commenter nailed the flip side. Their kitchen knives aren't fancy, but using them is a joy because the skill is ingrained. The tool vanished into muscle memory. That's the actual goal. This matters beyond text editors. Every open source project faces this tension. Are you building something that disappears into someone's workflow? Or are you building a clubhouse with a secret handshake? The projects that win long-term are the ones nobody talks about at lunch. Because everyone's too busy shipping the thing they actually came to build. The best tools don't have fan clubs. They have users who forgot they're even there. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 11th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sane 4.7. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something worth disappearing into. We'll see you back here tomorrow.